truthfully, what happens is, as children grow up, we start to educate them progressively from the waist up. And then we focus on their heads, and slightly to one side.
I think in the old days, you know, you were better off. Because nowadays, they're all specialists. Everyone's becoming better and better, and less and less. And eventually, someone's going to be superb at nothing.
Our education system has mined our minds in the way that we've strip-mined the earth for a particular commodity. And for the future, it won't serve us. We have to rethink the fundamental principles on which we're educating our children.
We're not here to tell everybody that they're wrong and we're right. We're not saying that we have all the answers, but we'd like to present a different way of looking at it.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to episode 3 of China Jeddication. Exciting one for you today. I have a special guest, none other than a Mr. Alan Wilkinson. Alan, could you tell us, the listeners, myself, what position in the education field you're currently in, what you're doing at the moment?
I'm here in Hangzhou in China, been here for around about a year, involved with BASIS International Schools, which is an American outfit. And we're setting up a brand new school here. We've got two sister schools already. One is in Shenzhen and the other one is in Guangzhou. And we're hoping to open, well, not hoping, we're definitely going to open this school in September of 2018.
Yeah, and it's exciting stuff. I mean, as we look out the room that we're in, the skyscrapers abound, don't they, in Hangzhou. I haven't been here for 10 years. I was here for the full solar eclipse. Came here with my wife 10 years ago, which was amazing. But my gosh, the way it's developed in 10 years, it just says everything, I think, about China at the moment. How are you feeling in this new city? Because you got here, you haven't been here long, have you, Alan?
Not terribly long. I've been in and out, but I've lived here now full time for around about, I guess, 5 months. I drifted over to see the development of the school last year, 2017. But I've always had a really good feeling about the city. It's incredibly beautiful. It's 8,000 years old. And it's just got, I think, all the right ingredients for me. It's kind of, it's got history, but the modernity is really quite beautiful. If you look online, you'll see a very large golden spherical building. And actually, in real life, it's way more impressive. So I would recommend it to anybody. And it's certainly a touristic destination for Chinese people, so I think that says something about the beauty and the interesting places there are to visit here.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the West Lake, massive West Lake, that seems to be what attracts it in the first place. And of course, being 45 minutes away from Shanghai on the fast train. But yeah, I'm really impressed, and I had a worry that the air pollution would be bad, you know, being up in this area with all the industry, but speaking to people, it's just getting better year by year, so wonderful. In fact, today, it's almost like we're moving into spring. It's like being in England again, on one of those rare days where we get sunshine in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, I like it here as well because it's got seasons. I was living in Shenzhen, which is a kind of subtropical city, and you get up and it's pretty much the same every day, but here we've had snow. We're moving into spring now. I think the summer can be very hot, but I love variations. I think maybe that's my Northern European roots, but I love the idea that it will change over the course of the year rather than just be static.
So I mentioned England. I think it could be considered obvious for our listening audience that you may come from somewhere in that fine country. Can you let us know where exactly you did come into this world?
Sure. I'm really from just outside the town of Shrewsbury, which is in Shropshire. I grew up there, I guess left when I went to college, never really went back, I suspect. But I've been outside Britain. I've been in international education for, I think, around about 25 years now. So it's been quite a long time, and I get back to Britain very infrequently now. I've made my home somewhere else in the world, so Britain isn't really the top priority destination for me anymore than it once was.
Yeah, I mean, and talking with you over the last few days, you really have had a really colourful, really interesting career, both within and outside of education. I think we'd need hours and hours of recording time to get some of the great stuff that you've that you've told me about, Alan. But in terms of education, because this podcast is focused on education, where were you educated? Was it in Shrewsbury then? That's where you did your...
Yeah, I was in a little tiny village, I'm not quite sure what went on, but I seem to start school 2 years earlier. I know that when I got to year six, I know I spent 3 years in year six before I could go on to the next part of my journey. And I've got a feeling that, you know, that was a fantastic experience. To grow up in those days, it was kind of the pre-computer times. I was, you know, that summers were spent, you'd just go out. Your mother would just tell you to come home when it was dark and everything felt safe and lovely. We probably lived in a fool's paradise, but it was fantastic. So it was a long childhood, I think, which is quite a gift in retrospect. And then I kind of sometimes feel disgruntled about this, but I passed the 11 plus, and it meant that with a small number of us in the village, we went to a grammar school. And as of that moment, you couldn't really associate. There was a stigma attached with going to the grammar school, and everybody else, all your kind of old classmates, going to what was called a secondary modern school. So I've got to say, I never really enjoyed secondary education, and I've often wondered subsequently would I have been better not passing the 11 plus, and also. I think those were the days when people, I think they're shocked now by the idea that we were beaten quite a lot. It was quite okay to be caned and hit and things thrown at you. So there was kind of a culture perpetual culture of bullying. I think it was pretty much countenanced in secondary school. And you saw a lot of things which were quite intimidating, I think, as a kid. I think one of the things I've carried forward was I haven't always been a teacher. That's for sure. Didn't actually ever intend to be a teacher. No. But one of the things I think I carry with me is the idea that I truly wouldn't want kids to go through what I went through, which I think is unusual. Most people seem to love their school and they talk about it, you know, through rose-coloured glasses, I think. But in my case, I wouldn't have recommended that to anybody.
Can you frame the decade that took place in? Alan, just
sure, that would be through the 1970s.
Yeah.
I went to college the latter end of the 70s. But I was born the late 1950s, so I can remember England winning the World Cup, watching on the black and white TV. I can remember Hour Cuts, which got me onto Radio 4, because we had lots of strikes through energy issues. And so as a kid, I discovered Radio 4, it meant I read a lot, etc. So all that kind of mischance, I think, helped me a lot, maybe subsequently in education.
Wonderful. And to place that, if you hadn't have passed that 11 plus, what would have been your, what would have been the outcome? You wouldn't have gone on to the grammar school.
Well, yeah, I mean, the grammar school was a bit of a rarefied place. And as a working class kid in that grammar school, they took 60 boys a year, and then there were, you know, there must have been five schools soaking up all the rest of the boys. It was like, you know, it was quite a bad ratio. And they ran it like a pseudo public school. You know, you were called by your surname, and it ran on those kind of lines.
Right, right, yeah.
But, I mean, I have no idea. If you went to what was a secondary modern school, in truth, I don't know. But I do think socially I would have been happier, because I wouldn't have been like three kids in bright green blazers getting on a bus and amongst about 200 kids and having to go and pick up your shoes periodically because somebody's thrown them through the window on the bus and all the rest of that. So you kind of ran for your life afterwards, and giving us a bright green blazer was tantamount to paint the target on your back. So anything in the village, kind of social things for kids, we could never go to it. We were not invited, and or you'd just be bullied, etc.
Oh, terrible! That's really quite a eye-opening insight there into the 70s in England.
It was a tough time, 70s. I think people watch things on the TV, and you think people would dress like David Bowie or Elton John going around. Not true. I think it looked more like Gdansk. It was a tough time. You know, football violence. Because football was like the working class opera, as I think some people call it. and it was a tough time. And some people go back to the '70s in Britain as if that was a time when Britain was maybe as close to a revolution as we've been to in many a long year. So I think, and you never had anything, you know. I think I've lived in Eastern Europe, and our lives, in fact, what the haves that we had were not so dissimilar as working class people to what was happening on the other side of the Iron Curtain, which is quite a salutary thought.
Yes,
I mean, I've got friends in Eastern Europe, and they think, oh, you could go on holidays and you could do this. Well, you could, but you had to afford it, you know. You could have a car if you could afford it. You could do this. So talking to friends from there, that the things we had, you know, were incredibly similar to that side of the Iron Curtain, amazingly.
Speeding it forward a bit, as you were growing up, so where were you taken for university?
First time round, I went to Birmingham. I studied psychology and economics. And Birmingham, I really enjoyed Birmingham.
Yeah, it's a great city, isn't it?
You were kind of vaguely unusual in those days if you'd been to university.
Right, yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
So I think it gave you certain opportunities, so I won't bore you, but I've had other careers.
Alan, was university paid for it?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I think now the fees, although they're not extraordinary, but the fees, etc., paid for it, and you had a grant. And it wasn't incredibly generous, but I mean, it was livable in a way that I think it isn't today. It was way more generous, I guess, than the situation kids find themselves in England. Maybe not Scotland, because I think they've still got free degrees. But it was okay financially as a working class kid to go.
So out of all of that, all of your education growing up, was there a favourite teacher? I mean, everyone says we all have one that pops out that really inspires you. Do you have anyone to know?
I do, but I'm going to kind of break the trend maybe on that, because my favourite teacher is somebody that I actually worked with, without a shadow of a doubt. I think I'm entitled because I've been in schools a long time now. And sadly he died last year, and he was the best, I think the best teacher I've ever encountered, the most caring, the most empathetic, and one of the most creative. And I describe him to others because if you went in his classroom, it was a hive of industry, and you struggled to find him because he was always working with a group of kids, etc. And so when you ask that question, that's what resonates, because I don't believe I worked with anybody who was quite as magical in terms of relationships and in terms of patience and care and making things fun. He was an exceptional person.
Wonderful. What was he teaching? What did he teach?
Andy was a teacher of basically upper primary. I think like the golden age is probably year four, but he taught year six. And yeah, very, very sadly, he passed away incredibly suddenly last year. And a lot of schools lost an incredibly important person who's had a wonderful effect, I think, on kids' lives. So yeah, people who are favourite teachers when they were kids, and I do have some that possibly qualified, but I don't think anybody was in Andy's class. So he's somebody that when I speak every year to new teachers, I don't necessarily name him, but I tell them what I think is fantastic, and I describe the way he taught and his reaction to things and his care. And so he's my model.
Okay. I mean, I love the fact that you go into the room and Andy can't be found because he's down somewhere, you know, working with the students.
Yeah.
That's quite a wonderful thing to imagine. Thanks for that, Alan. So in terms of you as a teacher, what subjects have you enjoyed teaching? What's your favourite?
I think I enjoy most going off piste, really, as a teacher. I've been, because I'm old and ugly and I've been allowed to kind of run certain things, I can kind of get away with stuff that maybe when you're teaching mainstream you can't. So the things I've enjoyed most, I write kind of simulations, which maybe a whole school will do over 2 or 3 days. So we'll vertically stream kids, we'll give them a set of problems, we'll give them like a story that will envelop over that time, and kids will work together. And those for me have been hiatus moments, because kids refuse to go for lunch, kids refuse to go for break, and they are just so energized, I found. Now, I don't think if you did that all the time, then I maybe it wouldn't work. Maybe it's got to be something that is unique, and they do occasionally. But I love writing those things, and I love putting them together and organizing them. And I certainly love what I see in terms of relationships between kids develop. So, yeah, I've taught some of, like almost everything, I think, now. But those are the special times that I've seen.
Do you think when Basis starts up in Hangzhou next year, will you be teaching? I think you're probably going to have your hands full, aren't you, with a whole new school and teaching staff and things like this. Is that something that you like to do as a head, to muck in sometimes into the classroom, or are you more kind of in the back, in the office, so to speak? Where does your style?
I like to teach. It does get tough, and the bête noire, I think, of running schools now is email, because it hangs over you like a dense black cloud, that if you don't answer things, you know, you've got to get there eventually. And when you get upward of 200 emails a day, you just feel like, I mean, in my case, rather stupidly, I've not had a holiday in about 7 years. I think the idea of having to come back and deal with that stuff is just too off-putting. So I think it's good to teach, all right, if you're in management in schools, because you can very easily forget how draining it can be to teach in terms of energy, creativity, etc., and the uniqueness of classes. I don't like people to sit in judgment in terms of inspection when they can't teach. I think, yeah, I'll be tried by my peers, but I'm not going to be tried by somebody who's a professional inspector. I think that it's difficult to get into the classrooms, but it's not impossible. And I certainly want to be a face and a person kids know. I think you've got to be very visible as a head personally.
Right, yeah.
I think that's an imperative. You know, it can be onerous to stand on the door in the mornings and shake people's hands. But after a while, it gets great, and you kind of know people, and you introduce parents to other parents, and it can be, you think you're building community around that. But yeah, the idea of being in an office on my own, I would be lonely. I've never really used that, I think, as a device. I've liked to have kind of like the round table with a room with everybody that can come in. I'm there, everybody's there. Because I think the idea that you say, oh, we'll have a meeting next Thursday, you know, 2 o'clock, then I find it never happens because somebody falls over or something like that. So it's much easier, I think, to be fluid and dynamic and be available and be a real person, you know, understand the people around you.
In terms of management on a student level, the focus on discipline, what's your philosophy on that, Alan, as a head of school with, you know, obviously teachers, I'm sure from back in the day when you were describing earlier, wouldn't be having canes in the classroom or anything like this. What do you think is the best way to...
Well, I'm pretty adamant about this because I taught in, I think, what would be regarded as an incredibly challenging environment years ago in Liverpool. And it was a very socially deprived area, and a lot of children were bringing issues into school, which I guess now it would be like a Ken Loach movie or something. But we changed our philosophy, and it was an American concept, I think, that time, by a guy called Lee Cantor, called positive discipline.
Yes, positive assertive approach.
Yeah, and I think teachers have got to be open-minded. I think one of the issues with teaching is everybody probably learns to be a teacher to a broad extent when they were in school themselves, and they're kind of entrenched. So I think it's the toughest industry to change. But I'm adamant that positive discipline, whilst it took a bit longer, it was way more productive. And it's a way of not allowing your emotions to influence a situation. I work on the premise that most kids do something wrong because there is something wrong. It's attention. They need to be noticed. So positive discipline is a way to try and look past as much as possible those infractions. But when kids are doing the right thing, that's when you notice them. And certainly in that pretty tough environment, it took a bit longer. But when we started to use that and kids got used to it, their behavior certainly got better. And I felt that the most valuable aspect overall was that kids started to praise other kids. That was unusual, I thought. They would congratulate each other. And when I saw that, I thought, this is for real. You know, you're creating people with new coping strategies. So anybody that wants to look at that, I'm sure it's widely used these days. It wasn't. It was new in those days. But I suspect it's widely used. But, you know, it keeps your temper at a low level. Occasionally you can erupt, admittedly, but it's a rarity. You shouldn't. And you take the emotion out and you say to kids when they do something wrong that if you're going to use a sanction, it's their choice. It's not you. You chose the sanction. Kind of sorry you've got the sanction, but you chose it. So it's not me. It was your choice. So it works well, and I think it gives people another strand to their emotional intelligences.
Great stuff. Being or having that experience of working in schools around the world, now you're in China, and you'd say you're a relatively newbie here in China. You've done some stuff in Shenzhen, haven't you? You've been there for 5 months in the basis there. What do you see looking ahead with the new school opening could be your biggest challenge being in this China environment, Alan?
Well, I think people look at international schools remotely, and I guess the model that we've had in the past is that you've got maybe a small number of local children, and then you've got an expatriate population, and your lingua franca could indeed be English, or it could be French or German, but that would be the way the school ran, and it would be a polyglot culture. But I think that what I'm seeing now is that whilst it says international, there's not an international clientele. You're seeing schools with overwhelmingly they're populated by Chinese kids. They've got international documentation because that is available to them. And I guess that brings some cultural issues. But it certainly means that a lot of these children, their English needs a lot of garnering. I think that's going to be a problem in this school that we embrace for quite some time to come, because as we admit children maybe from about the ages of 10 and up, if they're coming from schools which have been bilingual, they're not going to be truly conversant in English. And I've discovered in the past, it might be very individual, but kids over 10, if they've not written in English, they find it very difficult to write in an academic voice. They'll write as they speak. And sometimes you think they're wonderful in English, only to find when they write, it's very difficult for them to modulate the style. So, and that takes a lot of, I think that takes a lot of effort. So I think our greatest hurdle will be this conversancy in English, because these kids now are bound for American colleges. So they've got to be ready to be as good as their American counterparts when they get there.
Okay, as we come to the end of this conversation, we must have, as always, a teacher's tip. A recipe for success if you want to compete. Yes, I think, Alan, you have so much advice, especially over the last few days, that I've taken on board from yourself. Could you give something, I know you've got so much, but just one real paramount one, that could be, you know, as a tip and advice to an international teacher in China or around the world, or even as a leader in administration.
All right. Well, sadly, I can't. As an old soldier, I've probably got too many tips.
But
I guess
far too many.
As you talk about people coming to China, and I think internationally, if you're new to this sphere, and it's always going to be exciting, because otherwise, why else would you have signed up to come? So the first point is that once you go over that excitement, you realize it's a job and you've got to make a life. And that can be quite a salutary experience. And sometimes people feel a bit disappointed, ironically, I think. They have to pick themselves up again. Mm-hmm. So I guess I've got two tips, if you'd allow me them. First thing is that change is tough, and change, it always gets worse before it gets better. All right, but realize that it will get better, but it doesn't matter if it's a change for the better, it will always get worse before it gets better. And the other thing I would say is, the first year you're in a school internationally, try and be good to yourself, because you might not be as successful as you hoped. You're entering a new pattern, a new model, and you need to get used to it. And I think that year is kind of almost tantamount to one day. You've got to go through the entirety of the year so that the next year you'll understand exactly how to pace yourself. You know, the different nuances of dealing with parents, dealing with written report cards and things like that. It can all feel incredibly energetic in the first year and take you by surprise frequently. Mm-hmm. So that year, it probably harks back to this notion of change. It's probably going to be tough. But it will all come good for you. So be good to yourself.
There you go. Worth its weight in gold, I think, all that. Alan, we wish you all the best for the new year coming. We'd love to actually keep, I think, in touch to see how the year goes, and hoping we can have some more conversations through China Education again, because I feel this is going to be a very positive story in Hangzhou. Thank you for being on with us today.
My pleasure.
Enjoy listening to the China Jedi podcast and want to get involved, either by asking a question, expressing your opinion, good or bad, light or dark, or even appearing as a special guest, then get in touch by emailing our team at info@chinajedi.com. That's info@chinajedi.com.